second case of the day, the United States versus Blanchard. Mr. Kirshner? You may proceed. Ms. Kirshner?
May it please this court, counsel. My name is Bob Kirshner, and I'm appearing on behalf of the defendant in this case, Marshall Blanchard. Judge, the trial in this case was very brief. The first day of a scheduled week-long trial was essentially consumed with the selection and impanelment of the jury, and the district court did most of the examination with respect to those jurors. Towards the end of day one, the state called as its first witness Marshall Blanchard Jr., who was the defendant's son, and truly a key witness in the case with respect to the firearms which were at issue, and also to some extent in identifying a odor of ammonia and some canisters that were located in the kitchen area and a closet off of the kitchen, which is near where the laundry was done as well. The second day of the trial continued with Marshall Jr.'s testimony, and it is the first instance during the course of these trial proceedings when the district court interjected and indicated a degree of unhappiness about the pace at which the trial was proceeding. Specifically, during the course of Marshall Jr.'s testimony, I raised an objection to permitting him to render an opinion as a junior college student about his belief that some substance found in the kitchen was methamphetamine. In response to that objection, and this appears at 105 in the transcripts of the report of proceedings, the district court said, "We're not going to make an objection on every question unless you want to say, quote, I object to every question he asks. Then I can make a blanket, but otherwise we'll be here next week, and we're not going to do that." That was kind of the first instance before the jury that we point to in our briefs and that we raise a concern about with respect to whether the district court and the district court's comments with respect to the jury and in the presence of the jury tainted the defendant's right to a fair trial. There was a further examination, and then there was a recess. When the jury was brought back from that recess, I was then instructed to resume the cross-examination, and this appears at 198 in the transcripts. But before I could even ask that first question following a recess, the court said to the jurors, quote, "For the jurors, I did not voir dire any of you for the next week, and so therefore I do not intend to impinge on any of you next week for jury service. So if the trial, quote, which is going very slowly, does not conclude this week, don't worry about it. You won't have to come back Monday." This is during the course of the cross-examination of what is really one of the government's most important witnesses, equally, if not more important, than Cynthia Blanding, in part because of the relationship between the defendant in this case and this witness, who was his son. And that relationship was pointed to and commented on during closing arguments, I think with some significance. Continuing on in the transcript, beginning at approximately page 215, and this continues through page 220, after cross-examining the defendant's son, and in particular trying to point out before the jury that he had made conflicting statements. And there were a number of conflicting statements here. There was testimony that he had given before the grand jury, which we were unaware of until and during the context of his suppression hearing, at which time he was impeached, I think effectively, by the government with respect to inconsistent statements that had been made in the suppression hearing vis-a-vis those statements he had made before the grand jury. Following his initial testimony in that suppression hearing, there was concern which he had raised, which he had subsequently discussed with the case agent and with the prosecutor in the case, and it was very clear to Marshall Blanchard Jr. that the government believed that his testimony had not been truthful. And during the cross-examination of Marshall Jr., for example, beginning at page 210 of the transcripts, the question which was asked him on cross-examination was, did they tell you that you could be charged with perjury for what you said before the grand jury? And his answer was, they told me that lying under oath, I could be charged with perjury. Further inquiry was made of him with respect to...
Who is they?
He was referring to a post-testimony meeting that involved the case agent, and then subsequently, after that initial meeting with the case agent, the prosecutor in the case. But to be fair and to be complete, this concern, and this later comes out and is part of our concern about the way in which the trial was conducted, this concern was first expressed by Judge McCuskey during the course of the suppression hearing when he ultimately made some comments and some findings about his being Marshall Blanchard Jr.'s lack of credibility. So he continued on in that cross-examination, and the question that was asked at 211 was, so the government was telling you they thought you had been dishonest, correct? And his answer was yes. And then on the next page, 212, did Mr. Bass, who was the prosecutor in the case, tell you during that meeting again that he believed you had been untruthful when you testified under oath on November 15th? Answer by Marshall Blanchard Jr., he felt I was untruthful. Question, did you discuss the specific portions of your testimony which he felt you had been untruthful about? Answer, we went over everything in this, the parts that I fumbled upon. Next page, 213, you had been advised and had concerns about the suggestion that on November 15th the government believed you hadn't been truthful, correct? Yes. Question, and that there was this cloud of a perjury charge because of that testimony, correct? Yes. So the cross-examination was intended to point out to the jury that there had been discrepancies in the testimony which was offered. There was grand jury testimony. There was testimony at the first of a two-part suppression hearing, because the suppression hearing was reopened following concerns being raised about the truthfulness of what he had said at that suppression hearing. The assumption seemingly made by the court and by the government was that the grand jury testimony, and more importantly, his recanted testimony when he came back for the continuation of the suppression hearing, that that was the truth, and that what he had initially testified to during the first part of the suppression hearing was not truthful. Our position was that it was up to the jury to make that determination, and that we, as advocates and in our role as defending Marshall Blanchard, was entitled to and should point out to the jury these inconsistencies. Continuing on 215, Marshall Jr. Said at the bottom of 214 to 215, question, now on December 12th when you came back, you were asked about these conversations with Mr. Fritchie, that's the case agent, and you, page 163, counsel, testify that you had figured that if you cooperated and met with him, you might have a better chance. Do you recall saying that? Yes. What did you mean by that? His answer was, well, I figured if I showed signs that I was willing to right my wrongs, maybe I would get some mercy from what I did. And these wrongs to which you were referring are the portions of your testimony on November 15th, which the government says they didn't believe. His answer was correct. There was nothing in that line of questioning, in our judgment, and it is our position, that should have prompted or permitted the district court to permit the government to read the district court's findings at the suppression hearing to the jury. Because what it resulted in was the government, and this begins at page 220, saying to Mr. Blanchard, Marshall Jr., do you remember what the judge said to you? I objected. I asked to approach the bench, which is discretionary. I understand that. But I didn't believe it was appropriate to have a colloquy between counsel in the form of objections in front of a jury arguing about whether the government should be permitted to read to the jury the district court's findings of credibility on the very witness we were attempting to demonstrate to the jury wasn't entirely candid on several occasions, one of which was before the grand jury. The court, in response to that request to approach, this is at 221, denied that, and then, and I won't repeat all of what is in here, but essentially the court permitted a reading of its findings, and this is quoted verbatim beginning at page 9 of our brief, or initial brief rather than the reply brief, at which it appears halfway down in that quoted material, the prosecutor saying to Marshall Blanchard Jr., do you remember, shortly after I began asking you questions, do you remember Judge McCuskey saying, quote, the courts had a chance to observe the manner and demeanor of the testimony. I again asked to approach. On the next page of our initial brief, Mr. Bass continued reading from the court's ruling, and he read accurately, which is what the district court said was the only objection that I could raise, was whether he was reading the court's ruling accurately. I tried to object on the basis of relevance. I tried to object on the basis of Crawford, thinking that perhaps that would signal to the judge my concern was that we were having what Judge McCuskey then characterized as his judicial testimony, clearly weighing in on these proceedings, and this appears at page 10 of our brief, where the court is quoted after my Crawford objection as saying, hearsay, it's my statement, you've got the record, has he misread it? Hearsay, it's a direct statement of the court in a judicial proceeding. You, directing the comment to me, were present, you have a copy, has he misread what I said? Crawford, that's a Supreme Court case that has to do with cross-examination of a witness outside the presence of the court. And then here's the comment to which I referred. The court says, this is reading judicial testimony. Objections overruled. Has he misstated any of it, or has he read it correctly, Mr. Kirshner? I believe he's reading the transcript. Continuing on in the transcript, the prosecutor continues. This is again quoting from the court. And of course now Mr. Bass has asked him specific questions and led me, the court, this is in front of the jury, to the undeniable conclusion that he, referring to Marshall Blanchard Jr., has not been credible because he knew that his answers that he was giving were not the same answers that he had given to the grand jury. Well, part of the problem with that and part of our objection to that was that there was a fairly significant volume of testimony before the grand jury. And so for the court to weigh in on this and essentially, in our judgment, tell the jurors that the court has already determined that the testimony we are attempting to impeach was not credible. The court had already determined that. And with complete recognition of the standing and the influence that a district judge has and the manner in which jurors clearly look to the court, there's no way for us to quantify, no way for us to tell this court this is what influenced the jury or this is what did not.
Kirshner, I hate to interrupt you. I know you're near the end of your time, but I do have one question about this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does it make a difference that this episode happened with respect to a witness as opposed to the defendant? The defendant did not testify, and the judge made no comments about the defendant's credibility. Does it make any difference that this was a witness? And I know you contend that an important witness.
Your Honor, I guess my response to that would be this. We all know that the lawyers are not supposed to, and the credibility of the lawyers, are not supposed to be a factor in the outcome of the trial. But when you stand up in closing argument and you tell the jury, this is what the evidence was and here's how you should interpret it, the fact that the court, and in this dialogue, made it very clear that not only was he going to be permitted to read this to the jury, but that my objections and my concerns were devoid of any merit, I think, along with everything else, did have an influence.
Ms. Kirshner, I know your time has expired, and I'm going to give you a little time for rebuttal, but I want to ask you this question, and I want to be as exact as I can be in presenting it to you. And obviously, I want you to respond only if it's reflected in the record. And I ask you this against the backdrop of the dispatch with which you think the district judge was moving this proceeding along. Was there any time, either before the motion to suppress or after, and I'm again asking you whether the record reflects this, where there was an indication to this district judge that this case might not proceed to trial? I don't want to get into any matters between a defense counsel and the government. I'm just wanting to know whether this jurist was aware of any possible disposition short of a trial.
Judge, I think that the fair answer to that is no, but with this qualification. After we entered our appearance and during the course of the proceedings, there was a point in time that I cannot give you the date of where the case was continued specifically with the advice to the defendant that this continuance before setting it for trial was for the purpose of him reevaluating whether he wished to proceed to trial.
And this was a statement made by the court? What I want to know is what the court was aware of, if at all, about the pace of the case before going to trial. Whether there was an anticipation or indication that this might be resolved short of trial. You can understand why I'm asking this question.
I think the answer is no, and I would also point out that the trial concluded a day earlier than anticipated.
Yeah, no, I wasn't challenging the point about whether the case was dragged out. I just, against the backdrop of a judge that's charged with here, at least, of perhaps undue haste in moving the case along or indicating it ought to be more abbreviated, whether or not that was in any way impelled by indications before that they would have a different schedule, and I'm not suggesting that that should have made a difference. I just am trying to get a sense, as you suggested, of what it would have been like in the well of the court during the trial itself.
I do not believe the court had that indication, Judge.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kirshner. Mr. Bass?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Timothy Bass on behalf of the United States. Judge Flom, to answer your most recent question, my recollection is there was never a time where it was indicated to the district judge that the case would proceed other than to trial. The defendant was initially represented by the public defender. Mr. Kirshner and Mr. Lerner entered their appearance sometime thereafter. And from that point on, the case proceeded with pretrial motions, a suppression hearing. I do think the judge, if my recollection is accurate, at one of the pretrial hearings said something to the effect of giving the defendant a deadline for entering a guilty plea to achieve a timely acceptance of responsibility, but nothing further from that as far as indicating to the district judge that it would proceed other than to trial.
Thank you, sir.
Your Honors, if I may make 2 points at the outset. First, in the government's brief on pages 6, 37, and 40, I characterized the evidence of Ms. Blanding's testimony as to the last occurrence of manufacturing methamphetamine at the Roberts residence as being where she and the defendant smoked off methamphetamine in the garage. The accurate representation of the record after going back and looking at Ms. Blanding's testimony is that she testified that she brought materials to the defendant's residence where she and the defendant finished breaking down the pills, but that she then was the person who smoked off the methamphetamine in the garage. So I wanted to, at the outset, make that correction and apologize for that error.
What is smoking off?
Smoking off, Your Honor, is where a person combines salt with sulfuric acid to create hydrogen chloride gas, and that gas is then exposed to the pseudoephedrine solvent mixture, and when those two substances combine, the pseudoephedrine is converted to methamphetamine. So the act of...
It's the last act.
It's the last act. But she did testify that both she and the defendant were involved in part of the manufacturing process at the Roberts residence. It was just she that went to the garage and smoked off the methamphetamine. So I wanted to correct that representation in the government's brief at the outset. Secondly, Your Honors, I want to concede at the outset as well that in ordinary circumstances, and I would say 99% I would characterize as ordinary circumstances, it would not be relevant for the government to introduce evidence of a district court's findings regarding a witness's credibility in a prior hearing. Admittedly, a district court statements come with a certain amount of weight when conveyed to the jury. And I concede that. That's not a dispute. But this is not an ordinary case. This is an extraordinary case. And I think it's important to understand the context of how this evidence came in. This case would only have been brought, or only was brought as a result of the actions of the defendant's son. He noticed substance that he believed, based on his education, was tied to methamphetamine, and he had noticed observable changes in the defendant's demeanor in the months leading up to him finding this substance in his home.
Is he living with his father?
He is, Your Honor. He turned that substance over, took a sample of that substance, turned it over to his mother, who then contacted Long.
They were divorced.
They were divorced, yes, Your Honor. She then turned that substance over to law enforcement, who immediately then got a search warrant for the Roberts residence, which then led to a search of the defendant's Paxton residence. Thereafter, Marshall Jr. was called before the grand jury, and he testified to those very facts, his concern or what he had found. And the defendant thereafter was indicted. And at some point, the defendant learned of his son's grand jury testimony. And immediately thereafter, there was a motion to suppress the search of the defendant's residence. And the theory that the defendant advanced in support of that motion was to call his son, Marshall Jr., to testify that Marshall Jr. had an apartment on the front porch of the residence that was accessible only to Marshall Jr. and inaccessible to the defendant. And that's what Marshall Jr. testified to at the suppression hearing. He said all the firearms were his. He was the only one that had access to the apartment, even though if that testimony was true, would have voided any opportunity of the defendant to establish standing to challenge the search to begin with. At the end of Marshall Jr.'s testimony in the suppression hearing, the district judge made some pretty clear findings as to his observations of the credibility of Marshall Jr. And that very evening, Marshall Jr. reached out to the government case agent. We didn't speak with him. We didn't speak with him as he walked out of the courtroom or thereafter. He reached out to the government's case agent and said, words to the effect of, think I might be in trouble and want to correct that. And we then met with him and advised him of his rights, told him that he had no obligation to meet with us and that we were only interested in talking to him if he was willing to be truthful. And then he recanted his suppression hearing testimony and reaffirmed what he had said in the grand jury. And then at trial, that entire scenario, Your Honors, came out before the jury in direct examination. What happened with his discovery of the evidence, the grand jury testimony, he admitted to the jury that he'd lied under oath before the district judge in the suppression hearing testimony, and he described that day as the worst day of his life. And so all that evidence was before the jury, before Mr. Kirchner even got up to cross-examine Marshall Jr. And what made this case extraordinary was that counsel suggested falsely and without any good faith basis, not that the government just asked him about his testimony being untruthful, but suggested that the government attorney, myself, and the case agent said something to Mr. Blanchard Jr. as he left the courtroom. And also suggested...
He denied that, though, didn't he? Didn't Blanchard Jr. deny that?
He did, Your Honor. And he also suggested that that the government said to him that you'll be charged or could be charged with perjury if you don't testify differently. Now, it's one thing to point out to a witness, ask the witness if he's aware of the consequences of committing perjury. It's quite another to suggest that the government said to a witness, you're going to be charged or you could be charged with perjury if you don't testify differently. That was clearly a false suggestion conveyed to the jury. And I recognize, Your Honor, that the witness answered in the negative. But I would suggest to you that that didn't diffuse entirely the suggestion of improper conduct that was conveyed to the jury for which there was no good faith basis. And so that impression or that suggestion falsely suggested to the jury that the reason Marshall Jr. changed his testimony was because of some action on the part of the government, when the reason that he changed his testimony was because of what happened at the suppression hearing, culminating in the district court's very clear findings while the witness was still in the witness chair. Because the only thing that happened between Marshall Jr.'s testimony and his recanting of that testimony was the district court's statements. And so it was for that reason that I sought to introduce the district court's statements.
What I thought I took from your briefs was that you offered that portion of the transcript because of a false suggestion that it was the government who initially suggested to Blanchard Jr. that his testimony was false. And you were trying to show that it was really the judge who pointed it out to him.
Correct, Your Honor.
Why is that relevant? Who would have suggested the falsity of his testimony first? Why is that even relevant?
Well, I think that is a part of establishing who first suggested or exerted any influence, if you will, over the witness as to his untruthfulness was a reason for the witness's recanting, changing his testimony. And so it was my view that it was important not only to establish that it was the district court who first raised the issue of the witness's truthfulness, but because of that, that was the reason why the witness changed his testimony, not because of any improper action on the part of the government.
Your introduction of the evidence was not done with any sort of qualifying explanation, was there, limiting instruction, saying something to the effect that the only purpose for this testimony or transcript is to show who first introduced the subject?
No, there was not, Your Honor.
It was unqualified.
That's correct. There was not a request for a limiting instruction, although at the end of the trial, the district court certainly said, nothing I did during the trial, nothing I say now, is meant to give you any impression as to my view as to what your verdict should
be. And I want to ask you about that, too, because that portion of the transcript that you read to Blanchard Jr. was not something the judge said or did during the trial, but it was something he said or did at an earlier time. And the curative instruction that you point to doesn't address that, does it?
It doesn't address...
You see what I'm saying? The instruction says nothing I said or did during the trial was intended to convey a suggestion as to what you should believe or so on and so forth, however it reads. But it doesn't talk about things that a judge did or said outside of the trial context.
Correct, Your Honor. It certainly did not do that. But the judge's introducing evidence of the judge's finding of the witness's testimony in an earlier proceeding is not synonymous with the judge saying the witness now is telling the truth. The judge never said or suggested anything of that kind, that because I'm allowing my statements from the prior suppression hearing to be read to the jury, that I'm somehow giving the jury the impression or conveying to the jury my view that the witness now is telling the truth. Nothing like that happened of any kind. And so it was important, I think, the judge's instruction at the end of the case to say, whatever happened during the course of the trial was not meant to convey to you as to what your decision should be in this case. And their decision, which they also had an instruction on, was to decide the credibility of the witnesses. And the judge advised the jury that they were the sole judges of the credibility of the witnesses.
Wouldn't it have been a lot neater and cleaner for you to have just asked Blanchard Jr., wasn't it the judge who first suggested that your testimony was false?
Agreed, Your Honor. Agreed. I would say that it's difficult from reading a cold record to glean the entire context, but I would suggest that there was really no dispute as to when Ms. Marshall Jr. testified and the agony that he was obviously going through, there was really no question that he was that his testimony in the suppression hearing was false, and he admitted that to the jury. So if it could be done over again, could it be done in a different manner? Absolutely. But the question here is, was what was done prejudicial error to the defendant? And I would suggest to you three reasons why it's not. One, as this court has said, a party cannot complain about prejudice from evidence which he himself introduced. And I would suggest that that principle is applicable here. Even if you were to find that the admission of that this district court statements was error, it was harmless error for two reasons. One, the district court's statements did not present any evidence to the jury that wasn't already before them that Marshall Jr. had already emphatically testified to, namely, I lied under oath to the district court in this suppression hearing. And secondly, even if you put aside Marshall Jr.'s testimony in this case, the evidence without his testimony was quite strong, if not more so. And that evidence was that there were remnants of the manufacture of methamphetamine found at both of his residences, numerous items associated with the manufacture of methamphetamine. There were two instances of a seizure of methamphetamine from the defendant's bedroom. There was a seizure of a .32 caliber handgun from underneath his mattress, as well as several rounds of ammunition. He fled the jurisdiction, not Ms. Blanding. He was the one that fled the jurisdiction when he became aware of the charges. And he attempted to influence Ms. Blanding's testimony. So if you focus solely on the evidence, apart from Mr. Blanchard Jr.'s testimony, I would suggest to you that the evidence was quite strong, if not overwhelming, and therefore, for that reason as well, any error was harmless. And if I may say one other thing about the district court's comments, there's no question, if you read the record, Your Honors, that the district court was becoming frustrated about the pace of the trial. But most of the district court statements were made outside the presence of the jury, so there could conceivably be no prejudice to the defendant from those statements. And the statements that were made in the presence of the jury, all of which were not objected to by the defendant and therefore are reviewed for plain error. See, my time is up. May I finish the thought, Your Honor? So reviewing for plain error, the district court statements were simply expressing frustration, not individualized towards defense counsel, but towards the parties in general, that the jury had been told that they were only going to be here for a week, and it looked like they might be here beyond a week. And the district court asked the jurors, is that a problem? Let's recess, check your schedules, and get back to me. So there was no, despite that frustration, again, Your Honor, admittedly so, the question here is whether there was reversible prejudicial error to the defendant. And I think the record certainly answers that question in the negative. So for those reasons, we would ask that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Kirshner, your time has expired, but you may have 2 minutes.
Just very briefly, in response in part to the last comment that counsel indicated that most of the comments regarding the pace of the trial, which we recite in our brief and I believe, are clearly directed to defense counsel. There's interruptions during cross-examination. There's a suggestion to the government they should object more. But ending day two, there was a colloquy between the court and the assistant U.S. attorney regarding the pace of the trial. I was never even asked or involved in that colloquy. We were excluded from it. But day three, when day three began, this is at 3:55 of the transcripts, the jurors came in at 9 o'clock. What happened at 9 o'clock on day three, this would be the beginning of the second day of testimony. The district court spent 50 minutes, 15 of which were spent telling the jurors that the court's calendar was very congested, 3:56, that his wife and he had talked about his commitment to his legal work. He discussed his campaign for election as a circuit judge. He discussed his campaign for the election to the appellate court, talked about having tickets to the Final Four, talked about his other judicial commitments. This is between 3:56 and 3:59, and then asked the jurors to leave, go call their friends, families, and employers, and see if they could come back next week. This is at the beginning of the second day. So I think it is not entirely correct to suggest that these concerns about the pace of the trial were really outside the presence of the jury. They involved the jury immensely. At 2:10, beginning at 2:08 of the transcripts, there is discussion and cross-examination with Marshall Jr., and I think that if the court reviews that cross-examination, it is not a fair characterization to suggest that anywhere that in cross-examining him I said or indicated that the assistant U.S. attorney was the first person to raise this issue. So the foundation for the response as to why the court's comments were read, I do not think is borne by the record.
Thank you, Mr. Kirshner. Thanks to both counsel, obviously, and we will take the case under advisement and proceed to